Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Well, good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. We're glad you're here. Here at Driven to Business, we like to talk about business. We like to talk about careers. We like to talk about different parts of business, including marketing and everything else. And we have an unusual guest today, or at least in an unusual career, and we're going to talk about that. Let me remind you that we are streaming live on biz1190.com, and today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com. So check that out. Our guest today is Scott Hines, and Scott comes to us from Las Vegas. Scott plays Carl Perkins in the Million Dollar Quartet out there and also doubles on the upright bass. Scott, who plays Carl, has a great and interesting background. He was a school teacher in Tennessee and then ended up out there in Vegas. Scott, welcome to Driven to Business.
Well, hello, Eddie.
It's good to hear your voice again. Scott, you left a secure, full-time, and a very successful, really, teaching position in Tennessee to become a Vegas performer. Now, that's something a lot of people dream about. How in the world did that happen?
Well, it was, about 2 years ago, I kind of set in motion that I was going to be trying to become a full-time musician. So I just started trying to build the music career, save up money and whatnot. But at a gig one day, a musician out of Seattle said, "Hey, Scott, you would be good at musical theater." And I was like, "Well, I don't know about that." He said, "There's a show called Million Dollar Quartet, and it's about rockabilly, you know, 1950s music," and that's what I did, do. And so he's like, "You ought to try out for it." So I kind of, just on a whim, flew up to New York City because I was off in the summer, and they were having auditions in June. And I was like, "I'm going to go up there and just try out. And I probably won't get it, but at least I can come back to Knoxville and say, hey, I tried." And lo and behold, about 4 months later, I get this call out of the blue saying, "Hey, we need someone in our Las Vegas production."
What was that audition like? Did you play, sing, or what did you do? Act?
Yeah, I I went up there. I had to rent a guitar, and then I went in and just sang Blue Suede Shoes. And and the thing is, since I went in there fully expecting that I wouldn't get the job, that meant I wasn't nervous, I suppose, you know. So I just went in there and just did my thing and played Blue Suede Shoes as energetically as I do in a regular show, and they liked me because I could tell the other people auditioning they would just go in there for a second and then walk out. But when I went in, they talked to me for quite a while, and then the whole creative team walked out with me and took me to a back office to give me part of the script to memorize.
Well, I've seen you perform, something a lot of listeners have not done, and you are you're fun to watch. I've seen you in a couple of bands, and really, I don't mean this as a criticism. It's hard to take your eyes off of you because you are such a stage presence when you're up there. And I'm not surprised at all to find that you're doing musical theater.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. Back in my lower 20s, I did a little bit of acting at a local dinner theater in Knoxville, Tennessee. And then when that closed down, I just never really had much desire to get back into acting and shifted my focus to music. And this is the first time where my acting background and my love of rockabilly have been married so well together.
You know, talking about that, rockabilly for a guy your age is a bit of an unusual musical preference. It's pretty esoteric. What got you interested in that to start with?
Oh, the first time my exposure to rockabilly was I think I was in high school, maybe a sophomore or something, and I saw this this band on TV. And it was fronted by a guy with a big blonde pompadour, and he was playing a big red guitar, and it was the Brian Setzer Orchestra. And I flipped out, and I ran upstairs. It was real late at night, but I banged on my parents' door, and I said, "Turn on the TV! Turn on the TV! Look at this guy!" They probably weren't too happy about it, but it was from that day I was just sold. And so why I really fell in love with the genre is because it's a fun sort of music. It's the sort of music that doesn't take itself seriously and kind of winks at its audience while it's being done.
You know, you play slap bass, and both Joey and I, we play around at guitar, but, you know, you're actually a very, very good musician. But, you know, I remember you in my den one time trying to show me how you did that, and you would demonstrate it, and then I still couldn't do it.
I don't know. It's just become second nature, you know, to me by this point. But I think that's just because I wanted to play that style so badly that I just kept working at it.
Well, where did you get into the standing on the bass and putting it over your back and all that kind of stuff like you do?
There was actually a band that used to pass through Knoxville called the Dempseys, and they were based out of Memphis. But they put on a live performance unlike any other band I'd ever seen, and they did all the bass standing and crazy, you know, playing each other's instruments at the same time sort of thing, you know, and I just really fell in love with the energy and the fun, and then so I started diving into their influences and realized, well, here's where they got their stuff from. You know, I mean, Marshall Lytle, who used to be Bill Haley's bassist, he used to stand on the bass. And so then I started realizing there's all these cool tricks that have been done for, you know, 60 years and stuff. And
all of which, really, I guess I wouldn't have described it this way before, but that's really all sort of theater in a way that you're doing, which and even comedy to some extent. You know, the other bands you were with in Knoxville before, and I guess my point about this is you didn't just drop out of you're not just an acorn that fell off of a tree and rolled into an audition and became a Vegas performer. You had quite a bit of experience here in Knoxville and were quite well known in the Knoxville area as a musician. Tell us about a couple of your groups there.
Well, I guess my first group was probably the one that you knew about, was Jumping the Track.
Right.
At least my first group as an upright bassist. So that was I've only been playing upright bass for about, I guess I started about 10 years ago. And so it's pretty late in the game, I guess, for a musician. That's when I started trying some of this crazy stuff out, you know, because I always had this philosophy that if you can make the audience have fun by showing that you're having fun, that, you know, it makes it better for everybody, you know. And for a long time with Jumping the Track, and then I joined a band called Pistol Creek Catch of the Day, and I'm still... Well, before I moved to Vegas, I was still playing with those guys. It always kind of centered around, we have this common love for rockabilly. And then about just under 3 years ago, I formed a band called the Royal Hounds. And that more stemmed from, I want a band that I can seriously throw my talents into and throw my drive into and have a real band that was driven to take it kind of to the next level.
And you guys had a lot of success. I know you did a gig in Chicago, I think, or maybe even more than one.
We went up to Chicago. We did like a little miniature tour this past summer. And actually, while I was up in Chicago, I had linked up with the upright bassist for Million Dollar Quartet because they have a Chicago production. And we got the band in to see that show for free just because I'd never seen the show. I'd just auditioned for it, but I'd never actually seen it. So that was a really interesting trip up there.
Scott, you mentioned something a moment ago about having the audience have fun and obviously having fun yourself. You know, you may be surprised to know that when you talk to a lot of business consultants and good salespeople and things like that, one of the things they will bring up is that you really need to love what you do because that flows over into the way other people see you do it. And you're certainly a guy that does that. So, I don't think I would never have to ask you, are you having fun when I see you playing?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I absolutely love playing music. You know, when it's funny, whenever I double over on the upright bass in Million Dollar Quartet, people just come up to me and they're like, you are one of the most energetic bassist that I've ever seen in this show. You know, you have so much fun. I'm like, I'm not trying. I'm really not acting up there. I'm just having a ball, you know.
Well, that's always been my impression of you too. You know, just to tell folks that are listening, though, when you see someone like you on stage, you sort of expect this crazy person off stage, but then you come off and you're really and I don't mean this is any kind of criticism, you're a mild-mannered, sort of reserved person on a personal level. And so I've always found that very interesting. And you know what? People in radio, I know a lot of the guys here at the radio station would agree with this. A lot of people really good in radio are that way. They're very energetic in radio, and then you meet them in person, and they're these very quiet people. You think, wow, how do you carry on in radio like that?
Well, I think in a way, even though I considered, you know, years ago in my early 20s that I was giving up on acting, I really never gave up on acting. I suppose it's all acting. Even when I was a teacher and I was in a way performing in front of the class because I had to make the kids think that they liked my class, you know? And so even on stage, you know, some people get the wrong impression of me. They think that, oh, he's wild and crazy and just insane on stage. He must be that way off stage. But no, I'm really kind of a down-to-earth sort of guy, you know, and I'm able to bring out that quote-unquote character on stage.
But
you know?
We all, those of us that know you and have been around you also know you're you may be acting. The fact is you're very serious about this, and you've always been very serious in the way you attack it. And I've always admired that about you. Are you a little shocked now to hear yourself described as a professional performer? Does that shock you a bit?
It is kind of weird to say, I suppose, but I think more so than shocked, I'm relieved to say that. because for a few years, I have been working towards the goal of being able to leave teaching. Not that I didn't love teaching. But being able to leave teaching and pursue music full-time, because being a musician is not really a financially viable option unless you go about it the right way. And so now I'm finally in a position to where I can actually, you know, do this professionally, get a steady paycheck, and do, you know, what I love with this.
That's actually a great lead-in into what I want to talk to you about in the next segment, and that is the career that you've got going. Our guest today is Scott Hines, a member of the Million Dollar Place, Carl Perkins in the Million Dollar Quartet out in Vegas. I'm Eddie Mayfield. You're listening to Driven to Business, and we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. We're glad that you're here. We're talking with Scott Hines, who plays the role of Carl Perkins in the Million Dollar Quartet out in Vegas. If you haven't seen that act, that is a great act. By the way, I didn't tell you this, Scott, but I actually saw that act or a little portion of it here in Atlanta at a leadership conference where they had them come in and perform just a few songs. And I don't know where they were touring from. I'm not sure how that worked out.
Huh.
But that's I don't know any of the players in there, but it was pretty fascinating. It was very interesting to watch, very entertaining.
You probably saw some of the people that I work with.
Yeah, it may well be. It was really very, it was very, very fascinating. Scott, you were talking back before the break about the idea that you know, a lot of people, and we both know this, I call myself a musician only in the loosest terms possible, to use that term. I'm just a bit of an amateur guitar hacker. I do enjoy it, but I'm also around it as a businessman enough to know that I have many, many friends who wanted to make it in the music business, and it's a very tough business. I don't know of a more difficult business. Do you? I mean, to be successful in.
Oh man, I don't know. I mean, it takes a lot of hard work to get to the point where you are a legitimate, like, professional working musician, making money off of it.
Exactly. And there are a lot of guys, you know, I'm around guys just in little jam sessions that are just fabulous guitar players, but they're not, they didn't make it professionally. And it just shows you what a great thing it is that you did, and what it says about you. Since you've gotten out there to Vegas, well, before that, we were talking right before during the break, you and I were talking about, you have a little bit of a radio background, and it kind of flows into what you were doing. You were hosting a Blue Plate special radio program up there in Knoxville. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was a was actually just an internship that I did, but I had long since graduated college, and I pretty much went to them and said, "Please let me do this internship," you know. And they liked me. I'd been volunteering there for quite a while, and I just did the internship because one aspect of music that I needed to learn about was how to properly mix and edit sound. And I was very good at the performance side of stuff, but I wasn't very good at the technical side. It was a side I needed to learn. But also I just liked the people and I liked the environment and wanted an excuse to hang out there all summer. And so I helped run this live lunchtime radio show called the Blue Plate Special, and then got to do a little bit of hosting on the side.
You know, I'm thinking while you're talking, that little, even that what you said right then fits into so many areas of business and career, is that you really do need to prepare for what you're doing, and you need to prepare for all parts of it. I think there's this myth, and particularly around your career, that somehow you just get lucky and you just happen to luck into the right place. But I don't know, I can't think of any instance where that actually happens. Maybe it does, but I've never heard of one where that really happened. And when it appears that it happened, and you go beneath the water and look at what really is there, that's not at all what happened. It had nothing to do with luck.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. I think with being a musician, I heard a quote recently that 80% of success is just showing up.
Right.
You know, and that's true. With Million Dollar Quartet, there's so many musicians that I've met that have been like, "Oh, I would love to do what you do. I just could never do that." You know, and in my mind, I'm thinking, well, I mean, if you want to do that, you know, go try out. You know, and but you know, on the flip side, is that I think there are a lot of great musicians out there who won't have any success because they're terrible businessmen.
Right.
And I learned several years ago, I made an active choice that I was going to learn the business side of music so that I can have an edge on people. So right now I'm reading a book called Facebook Marketing for Dummies. You know, just because I want to know how to properly market our business. And I really think that's kind of where the success of the Royal Hounds came from, is because I studied the business side of things.
You did. You know, I'm struck. There's a quote by Samuel Johnson that I think you'll agree with. And I think it applies to musicians so well. It says, "What we would do with ease, we must first do with diligence." And of course, you know, people see you perform. What they haven't seen are the hours and hours and hours you spent practicing how to do what you do, because you don't just show up on stage and do that.
Yeah. And there's obviously, you know, rehearsals and things like this. I don't actually spend a whole lot of time, as far as bass goes, just practicing on my own, just because we were playing so often back,
right.
Back before I moved out to Vegas. We were playing so often that, you know, I just didn't have the time to sit down and practice things and stuff. But, you know, what I was spending my outside hours for was not only the studying and learning of business, and I would go to conferences in Nashville on music business every year, but the hours spent emailing clubs and trying to get dates booked and doing all the Facebook marketing and the website marketing and all those hours and hours of the business side behind the scenes.
Scott, right after you got out to Vegas, I remember a Facebook post you put out there up about some of your experiences, and you talked about how much work goes into a performance like the Million Dollar Quartet. You know, talk about that a moment.
Specifically the Million Dollar Quartet?
Or however you want to do it, even in general.
Well, yeah. I'll speak to the Million Dollar Quartet. It was it's funny because when I came out here, I was thinking, oh, this is going to be a breeze. I've been playing rockabilly all my life. You know, rockabilly is a simple form of music, and I got out here, and boy, I got an appreciation for how much work actually went into the arranging of those songs. It was arranged by Chuck Mead, who used to be the lead singer for BR-549. And I had to actually learn the specific guitar licks they would play on the original tracks.
Right.
And there were times where it got quiet and times where it would get loud, and I had to know exactly what pedals and pickups. So I spent a lot of time, 3 weeks, in my hotel room with my guitar, just trying to memorize those songs exactly the way they are. And so as soon as I moved to Vegas, I didn't actually get to go out and see Vegas for, you know, almost a month, because I came out here for a job. You know, and I think that's one thing that a lot of musicians forget, is that, you know, they want to be professional musicians, but sometimes they forget that, you know, the work that goes into it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you move to Vegas, of course, first night out, you want to go out on the town, but that's not why I'm here, you know?
You know, in every business, you see that. You see some guy will have a successful, you name it, business, and someone will say, man, I wish I had that business. You know, that I wish, you know, and the implication is the guy, it just sort of happened to that guy, just lucked into it. They don't, but you know, again, when you dig beneath it, the guy worked his rear end off to get that business to that point. It didn't just happen to him. I mean, any more than it happens to anyone else. Scott, excellence is a word that a lot of people toss around. You know, back when I was younger, you know, the book In Search of Excellence came out, and we all read that, and that sort of drove us. It's driven a lot of things since then. But excellence really is something that gets required in a performance like you're in, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's just strive. It's just drive to be good at what you do. You know, and I mean, there are just so many people that I've met who want to be, you know, want to have excellence. But again, going back to that, don't want to put in the work that it takes.
Right. We have about a minute left. Tell us right quick, there are people who may not know about the Million Dollar. Tell us who the Million Dollar Quartet is, or what they represent.
Okay. The Million Dollar Quartet was a Broadway show. It's since closed down on Broadway about a year ago, but it has variations. And it's the story of the one night that Elvis, Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Carl Perkins were ever together in a room. It was December 4th, 1956, and it was at Sun Studio in Memphis. And they just, by coincidence, all found themselves together, ended up having a jam session, and Sam Phillips, who was the engineer and the father of rock and roll, snuck into the booth and hit the record button. And so we have this recording of the four of them playing and talking and having a good time. And so this is a play that tells that story, and it's won some Tonys, and it's a great thing to be involved in.
Well, you certainly make it sound like fun, as I'm sure it is to do that. Even at your level and the work you've done, you do sound like you're having a lot of fun doing it. We are, Scott, if you can hang around during the break, you're listening to Driven to Business. We're streaming live on biz1190.com, being podcast on eddiemayfield.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. Welcome back. We're talking with Scott Hines, who plays the role of Carl Perkins in the Million Dollar Quartet out in Vegas. Scott, you are a very popular teacher up there in the Knoxville area. And one of the things I remember reading about was this garbage can band that you put together for your kids. Tell us about that.
Oh, the Trash Can Band, it started out as when I was a summer camp counselor and summer camp director. I just needed an activity to do. So we kind of made this version of Stomp, where each kid had a trash can and drumsticks, and we would tap out rhythms in unison. And so the main director, he was organizing the big national conference, the American Camping Association National Conference at the Opryland Hotel, and he needed something to kick it off. So he said, Scott, can you organize this? So I organized one with my school, with my students, and it became popular. So I got to apply my music business knowledge to an after-school club. And so what started out, you know, after the Opryland Hotel, we started kind of on a small scale playing school board meetings and a local Relay for Life. But I started using our gigs to build upon gigs, and we eventually got to play halftime at an NCAA championship for the Lady Vols in front of like 32,000 people or something. But it was the same sort of deal. I had fun applying my music business knowledge to an after-school club thing.
And, you know, you can just imagine those kids, how that they'll remember that the rest of their lives, the fact that they played at a Lady Vols game and had fun doing it. That's such a neat story, you doing it. We've had a lot of guests here on Driven to Business talk about the subject of education. We've had the Georgia State Director of Education on here, along with the governor and some others, all talking about that. But I haven't had a teacher on here. So from a teacher's perspective, just in general, what's your take on the present state of education in our country?
Oh, Lordy, are you sure you want to ask a teacher that? You know, I'm probably about to say the opposite thing of probably what most any guest would say out there, but I really don't think that the state of education in America is as bad as what many politicians like to give lip service to. You know, it doesn't matter how great we are, all politicians are going to say education is terrible, it needs to be reformed.
Right.
You know, and in many ways, I kind of think it demeans what we do. You know, I say we because I still consider myself a teacher, even though I haven't been in a classroom for a couple months. But, you know, one thing is I just don't feel like there's a lot of trust that the teachers can do our job, you know. But I've just worked around so many great teachers and so many passionate teachers that are doing a great job, but you don't get votes by standing up and saying, education's great. We're doing a good job, you know. So
I think in addition to votes, you're, honestly, at a political level, you're also talking money. The way a school gets more money is by saying, hey, we really got problems here. We need more money. So
That's true.
Politician do it. You know, teaching is a we do talk about leadership a lot here on Driven to Business, and teaching is, I mean, the moment you step in to a teaching role in school, you are a leader. I mean, that's a leadership position. You're leading a class, like it or not. And a lot of good leaders will say, and I've been surprised at how passionately some of them have said this, is that in order to be a good leader, you really have to love the people that you lead. Does that ring true with you and your experience in the classroom?
Absolutely. I really think I do. I was a good teacher, and not saying it in an egotistical way.
No,
but,
a lot of people said you were a good teacher. You're a very highly rated teacher.
Yeah, and I had the scores to back it up, you know. And I even won Teacher of the Month by a local TV station 1 year. So that being said, there was a year where I am like my students. It was a really tough year, and every other year, I mean, I taught for a long time, and every other year, I just loved my students, but it was a frustrating year, and I look back at that year, and I'm like, I wasn't a good teacher that year, at least in my own opinion. I don't think I was. You know, I still got good scores, but it was because I wasn't a fan of who I was leading. Now, every other year, I loved my students, you know, and I probably bad for a teacher to say they had one rough year, but everybody has it in no matter what business they have. But I love my students every other year, and it made me a great teacher, so that year that I had a rough year, I still was a good teacher, you know? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Look, I've never been a teacher, but I have led a lot of organizations, and I'll just leave it at that, where there were people in that organization that I really had a hard time liking, and I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
But and it does make the job a little hard. Now you got to get over it.
Yeah, and, you do. I mean, you ultimately have a job to do.
Right.
You know. Yeah.
But you know, we talked a little bit about this earlier. But you are anyone that would see you perform, you're a very, very, very passionate performer, and I've always admired that about you. Where did you learn that?
Oh.
And I should say, not just a performer. You're passionate in everything you do.
Yeah, I think it's just, golly, I don't know what it's from. I think it's just a general love of life. You know, I mean, and that's something, you know, that I would try to instill in my students also. You know, on my very last day as a teacher back in October, by that point, I knew that I was leaving teaching and that was my last day. And I had resigned to my principal, but I hadn't told the students, and I, in fact, didn't tell them that day until after I was gone. But my very last lesson, I threw out my lesson plans that I was going to do that day, and instead we did a lesson about being passionate about life and following your dream, because I knew that that's what I was about to do, and I wanted them to do the same thing. You know, so we just pretty much used the class time to talk about having passion for life and not being satisfied with the status quo, you know? And so I think that's just what it comes from, just an innate love of life.
That again points to what a good teacher you are. I think the idea you would have a discussion like that with the kids, because that really You know, music, you had mentioned earlier, music is a business, and you're really, I would relate you to being in a very niche of business. You know, the rockabilly certain a little sliver of business. In the business that I'm in, which is an entirely different world, but the electronic variable speed motor drives, most people don't even know what those are, so we're certainly in a niche. And, you know, one of the things I tell our kind of new people working for us, I'll say, you know, I'm talking to people that don't even know what it is. And so, well, then they're not a prospect. That's one thing, you know, for sure, because we only sell to people that know what they are. So, but it, in some ways it makes selling easier, in some ways harder, because I think in your profession, if you find someone that does like rockabilly, they're immediately going to like your music. I mean, that there's not any question about that. So in marketing it, I think finding those folks, and I guess the other way would be to introduce people to it that have not seen it before, and maybe like me. And I didn't know about rockabilly for a long time, but after I sort of began looking at it, I liked it, and I think there are a lot of people that way.
Well, you know, I think it applies to everything in life. If I learned one thing in recent years, it's you can sell anybody anything. I mean, it's true. And rockabilly is a genre of music that has been, for lack of a better word, it's been dead for, you know, 60 years. It had a revival briefly in the 80s, and then now it's kind of got this underground thing. But I had a lot of venues tell me, we don't want to book a rockabilly band. You know, they just wanted to book top 40 dance bands.
Right.
But because I had this vision and I knew in my mind that what we could bring to the table was going to be something that they'd never seen, that they really wanted, I kept at it. And even though we were facing people telling us you're going to fail, by the time I left Knoxville to move to Vegas, we were probably one of the hardest working bands in Knoxville, and we didn't have to go out and seek gigs anymore because the phone was ringing with people wanting to hire us, you know. And so I think that it's all comes down to presentation. You know, if you have variable motor, the thing that you want to sell,
that'd be VFDs. VFDs.
And it just comes down to presentation. You know, and so, for example, when I got to Vegas, I'm rebooting the Royal Hounds out here, and people are telling me, you know, it's really hard, believe it or not, to be a working band in Vegas, because you have the Strip, and then beyond the Strip, there's just not much else, you know. And but I take that as a challenge. You know, I'm going to take a band, and even though people have said you're going to fail, I'm going to try to make a successful band in this town, you know?
Hey, this may be encouraging to you. I read the other day, some guy said, you know, if you think marketing doesn't work, just think of the millions of Americans that now think yogurt tastes good. And I think
I love that. Yeah.
That's a great idea about marketing, actually.
And marketing is an important skill to learn. That's probably one of my favorite things that I'm into right now is marketing.
Well, you know, marketing generally is information. We always say marketing is information. Information is marketing, and it is a large part of it. Now, you have to get some sales sometimes over as part of that as well. But a lot of it's just figuring out how to get your message out in front of people, which, you know, this day and age is both easy and hard. I sort of vacillate about that. You know, we have so many outlets now of ways to get messages in front of people. You'd mentioned Facebook and a lot of other social media. And, you know, everybody's got a gazillion TV stations. And I don't know, you know, you got broadcast radio, you've got Sirius, you've got all this stuff. It almost becomes very hard to know, okay, where do you – and you can't do all that. So yeah. Where do you start? I think that's the tough thing.
I guess first start looking what you're good at. And I spend all this time on Facebook, you know, so I started kind of diving in about specifically Facebook marketing. Now, the tough thing about Facebook is will not be around forever,
right?
You know. In fact, many studies are showing that Facebook is kind of on the outs. So I'm also shifting a lot of my attention to building our email list,
right?
Because once you have someone's email, you will always have their email. Whereas Facebook could close down tomorrow and you'll lose your contacts there. However, Facebook is an incredible...
We have 1 minute here, Scott.
Yeah.
No, I didn't try to stop you, so we have 1 minute. It is interesting. You know, right at the break, I'll talk to you about that a moment. We do a fair amount. In fact, we've been very successful at email marketing, and it is... again, it's like everything else. There's little ins and outs of it, and people are funny about email. You know, they take it more personally. Like, you know, spam is what people say spam, and you know, you may not think it's spam. If they think it is, it's spam. So you got to be hard not to do that. Scott, can you hang around through one more break, and we'll finish up this conversation. You're a great guest. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
You are listening to Driven to Business, and we're talking with Scott Hines. You probably don't get a chance to hear a Vegas performer talk about the business of Vegas performing very often, so stick around. Back in just a moment. Welcome back to Driven to Business. In the final segment here, we're talking with Scott Hines. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. We're very glad you're here. Very interesting discussion today. Scott, we were talking about, we've talked about a lot of things, about you being a teacher and about you know, the music business and so forth. I was going to ask you earlier on, when you got to Vegas, I'm sure that you probably had anticipations of what was going to be there. What surprised you the most? Did anything surprise you when you got there that you didn't expect?
I mean, other than the fact that they have billboards advertising women, that was the most surprising.
Yeah.
what was surprising to me, which was a great thing, was the level of professionalism that they have out here. You know, I mean, with the music business or in the music world. You have a lot of musicians, and I don't want to be like dogging my fellow musicians or anything, but everyone knows it. You have musicians who just sometimes act unprofessional, just like with any business.
Right,
people
right.
that act unprofessional. You know, I've played with musicians who will be drunk by the end of a gig, so drunk they can't play their instrument, or who will show up an hour late, or things like that. But you get out here, and it's almost because there is so much talent here, and so many people want to be a Vegas performer,
right,
that it's almost like if you don't act professionally, well, there's 10 more people behind you who want your job, you know. And so I was impressed with the level of professionalism out here, you know, people who really see this is my job and I have to act accordingly.
In my a completely different career, but I do enjoy being around people that not only love what they do, but that are professional about it. And you know, Scott, I've been one of I hired a consultant many years ago in our business, and one of the criticisms he gave of me, this was many years ago, was that I was putting too much emphasis on skills versus attitudes. And I fought that at first, saying, you know, well, but I'm in a technical business, skills are very important, you know, technical skills. But what he was trying to tell me was that I was hiring people for their technical skills and ignoring their attitudes. And let me tell you, it doesn't matter what a person's skills are, if they are, as you termed it, unprofessional, or if they just, you know, in our case, they can't get along with customers, or they don't show up when they say they're going to at a customer site. It doesn't really matter how good they are technically. We're going to lose a customer over it. And so we began to adjust our hiring and our retention based on those things. And I'll tell you, things get a lot. One of the things I didn't anticipate happening at work, it became a lot more fun to work with the people we were working with, but because you're doing it on that level.
Yeah. I mean, you have to like the people that you work with. You know, you have to get along. And I think you'd mentioned earlier, I'd come across recently talking about shared vision.
Right.
And I think that is also something that is extremely important. You have to share a vision with who you're working with. When we started the Royal Hounds back home, it was the first time where instead of me saying, oh, we both like this kind of music, it was more like, I have a vision for this band and a vision for where I want us to go professionally. And so I linked up with this drummer who was also just that driven, and that's where he wanted to go musically. And we worked together great as a team because we shared the same end goal. See?
Yeah, I do. You know, Scott, I've made the observation. Again, I haven't played in bands like you have, but I played in a few. You know, there's something, and you will relate to this much on a much higher level than I do, but there's something almost kind of magical that happens when people playing different instruments, and you suddenly sort of just slide into that groove together, and you know what I'm talking about, when you're just really playing together and everybody's doing their part and people are taking different licks here and there, and it's just and instead of having five different musicians playing an instrument well, all of a sudden you become a sound, and that's almost a chilling thing, isn't it? I mean, of a sort.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just with anything, you know, all parts have to work together well. You know, if you have one link or one weak link, it's going to make everybody suffer. You know, but see, that's the interesting thing about being a musician versus, you know, I suppose being an actor, because right now I'm currently living in both worlds. Is musicians, I find, see, if you have an actor, one actor's bad, you can go, oh, well, that other actor's a really great actor, and that one actor there is not very good. But as a musician, if you have one musician who's bad, it just makes the whole band look bad. And, you know, and so same thing with any business. If you have one weak link, you know, no one's going to go, oh, well, this employee's great, but that employee's not very good. It'll just make the whole business look bad.
And I think even like you were saying when you started the band, the fact that you guys are sharing a vision, you can't have your drummer drumming a different beat than you're playing on your guitar. It's not going to work.
Yeah.
So you've all got to decide together. This is what we're looking for, this kind of sound, and everybody gets aboard with it. And there are a lot of lessons in life about that. I've used to use the analogy of a choir for the same way. You know, you've got usually four different parts singing in a choir, and you can't, you know, they've all got to stop and start together and be in the same key and all that. And it doesn't matter how good your soprano is if she's singing in a different key than you're in.
Yeah.
It's going to sound horrible.
Also, I think one of the major things about it is you also have to have flexibility.
Right.
For example, the guys in the band approached me about doing some Led Zeppelin songs, and they were classic rock guys. I'm more of like a rockabilly guy, and
right.
I'm like, oh, Led Zeppelin, I don't know, guys. We're a rockabilly band, even though Led Zeppelin started out as a rockabilly band. But I was like, all right, we'll try it. And we started digging into it. We came up with a Led Zeppelin medley where I got to do my best Robert Plant impression. And I ended up having a lot of fun. Just a lot of fun, you know. And the audiences, they really got into it. And so it became one of these signature numbers that we did. And though even though I didn't like the idea of it at first, I was open to it. And they came up with a really great idea.
You know, that again, that's just, I think, speaking to your leadership abilities. Scott, you know this so much better than me, and we've discussed it already, but there are a lot of skilled musicians that have not made it, and you did. And we've already talked about that a lot. Do you have anything else to say about perhaps why you made it and they don't?
You know, it's weird to hear people say you've made it, you know? And,
right.
And I have to kind of step outside myself sometimes and look, you know, to me, playing here in Vegas, it seems like another gig. You know, it's a great gig to have, you know, but sometimes I have to step outside myself and go, look, you've kind of got a brass ring here, you know? I mean, there are really only two ways to make good money in rockabilly, and that's with Million Dollar Quartet and then maybe playing with the Brian Setzer Orchestra. Beyond that, there just aren't many opportunities. But see, I hope that for me, that this isn't my one brass ring. This is the end-all, be-all. This is going to be the highest I'll ever get. To me, I hope this is just one step along the way. And when I leave Million Dollar Quartet, I'm going to try to look for something else and just use Million Dollar Quartet as a belt notch on my resume to build to whatever next step I want. You know?
Scott, you have a lot of humility in what you say, and people have not seen you play don't know really how good you actually are. Scott, in the 1 minute we have left, when it's all boiled down, what's the most important thing in Scott Hines' life? How do you want to be remembered?
I want to be remembered as a nice guy. You know, I mean, really, because there are so many people who make it through the business through sort of like catty backstabbing and stuff. But I like to take the Tom Hanks approach to performance and just be, you can still succeed and you can be nice to everybody along the way and build other people up, you know, always build other people up.
And you are a nice guy. Scott, thank you so much for being a guest today.
You.
It's been a lot of fun having you on. And I wish nothing but the best for you out there. I expect to hear big things for you the rest of your life in the performing or in whatever you decide to do. You're a success-oriented guy. But thanks for being here.
I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Driven to Business. We're here every Saturday morning at 11 o'clock here on WAFS, biz1190.com. Today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com, so we'll see you online. I am your host, Eddie Mayfield. Thank you for being here.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.